Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We're one of many, 27 or 28 lodges around the world who are part of the United Lodge of Theosophists, but we're all independently devoted to the cause of Theosophy. So we're not an organization, we're not an institution. We don't solicit any funds whatsoever, although all contributions of time, money, and service are certainly welcome. Everything's voluntary here, so you don't have to worry about coercion of any sort. So we're attraction, not promotion. That's been said other places too. So... We'd like to mention, too, that the doors open at 10:30 on Sunday morning, and from 10:30 to 11:30, you can, just relax, and then the meeting starts at 11 to 12, and there's also a book table available for your perusal. Most everything, pretty much everything is online now, but a lot of people like to, carry a book with them or a pamphlet with them just to whip out and meditate on. So on Wednesday evenings, we're studying The Key to Theosophy, which is a question and answer forum. It's more like a study class. On Sundays, we have different programs. Every month, we have like an overall topic, like an umbrella topic. And in April, we are discussing nature's symbols of human evolution. So last week we did the diamond soul in the Iron Age. This week's the lotus and the tree. And next week, watch your head there.
I did.
And next week we are doing Easter, physical and spiritual rebirth. So, we celebrate Easter a little differently. We're not a religious organization by any means, but there's great historic significance to Easter going back to ancient times. So we would like to read our declaration, although we highlighted a couple of things because it's this is our guide. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So, we'll have two short presentations followed by discussion. The first one will be on the symbolism of trees, and that will be followed by the symbolism of the lotus. Here's an opening quote from the Secret Doctrine. Excuse me. There are no ancient symbols without a deep and philosophical meaning attached to them. Their importance and significance in creating with their increasing my own writing. Let me start over here. There are no ancient symbols without a deep and philosophical meaning attached to them. Their importance and significance increasing with their antiquity. Also, the ancients knew that nothing could be preserved in human memory without some outward symbol. So we're really all very visual learners, and we have the five senses, of course, which are readily available, and a sixth sense, which is partially developed in some and more so in others, but that is not the topic of this talk. We are experiencing in the spring a rebirth, and the seed, we'll start with the seed, because the seed is what germinates, it's what thrills. It's been in the ground, in the hard, cold ground, for the winter time, and yet there's all kinds of hidden activity going on in that seed. There's really very little known about the seed. We know about the manifestations of the seed, but the seed itself, and we know, like, for certain seeds, there's actually like a carbon copy inside if you would cut it open. But for most, it's, if you cut it open, you can't really make much sense of it. It's almost impossible to conjure the words in English to describe adequately certain subjective concepts. And really, the seed is a subjective concept. It becomes objective when it manifests, as we're seeing around now in the springtime. We see the flowers. We see the blossoming, that's the end of the cycle, really. It looks to us like the beginning of the cycle, but we have the seed, then we have the branch, the root, the stem, the branch, the root, the trunk, the leaves, and the flowers, and the fruit. And inside the fruit is the seed. So that is a really great... when people, sometimes they kind of doubt reincarnation, but everything comes back, everything returns in nature. So we are all a part of nature. Why wouldn't we fall in the same category? And the ancients actually, they said that the humans are really like trees, that we're upside down in a sense, but we have our root ball in our head, which is in the sky, and our branches are on the earth. We'd like to read this. The tree is a common universal archetypical symbol that can be found in many different traditions. They are symbols of physical and spiritual nourishment, transformation, and liberation, sustenance, spiritual growth, union, and fertility. The tree is a spiritual motif and a framework, a map of conception and consciousness that brings together the temporal worlds of time, space, and consciousness. So the Norse had the world tree, Yggdrasil. It's a rather strange spelling. It's Yggdrasil, but we looked it up on Merriam-Webster's, and apparently it's pronounced Yggdrasil, you know what I mean. So it's a world tree, which all the roots are connected, and that's a theosophical symbol, that everything is connected, that all the lower natures, all our natures are all one, and we're all connected. There's also in the Sumerian and Toltec and other traditions, They all portray the macrocosmic world as represented by using roots. And it's interesting, too, because we talk about the various kingdoms in nature and, the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, and the human are the four kingdoms that we're dealing with. And we have in ourselves all of the lower kingdoms. They're all there in form. The mineral is cohesion. The vegetable is sensation. The animal is our nature. I mean, we're human, but we're using these animal forms. But we're self-conscious beings, so we're not like, animals don't plan and execute things. They work on instinct, but, so the human kingdom has all the various, the mineral, the animal, and the mineral, vegetable, animal, and human. Now, the tree, interestingly, it's really a crossover between, or a bridge between the vegetable and the animal. And it really does have a fair amount of mobility, not only in its branches, but in the roots, because it's constantly seeking new ground, seeking new water. And even if you cut a tree, the roots will grow for about 5 years afterwards, which a lot of people found out when they had plumbing problems after they cut the tree down. The tree actually continues to grow for about 5 years afterwards. Let me see. Okay. Oh, this is interesting. In Egypt, the holy sycamore is said to stand on the threshold of life and death, connecting the worlds. It stands as the eastern gate of heaven from which the sun rises each morning. A number of different types of trees had different functions and were sacred to different Egyptian deities. Now, the sycamore in particular was at one time the most popular tree to be planted in cities, and they're planted all over the world. If we go right down here to Rittenhouse Square, we'll see more sycamores than anything else. And they're kind of like mottled looking when they're denuded of their leaves. But they're beautiful trees. And the philosophy of theosophy is, in a sense, you could say the sycamore would be symbolic of the philosophy, because the London plane tree is actually an abrevieti or abrevieti, however you say that word. It's a combination of East and West. There's the sycamore orientalist and the sycamore occidentalist. And the London plane tree is actually a combination of both. So it's a marriage of East and West. And you can plant it anywhere in the world and it will grow and it will thrive. And that's a symbol that these ideas, when they were brought, the Theosophical Society, when it was founded in 1875, the whole idea was to restart, to repropagate the ideas that had been long lost because they had been overshadowed by Christianity and Islam and Judaism as well, that the three major religions and many other religions had really ignored the ancient teachings, absorbing part of it. True, there are many traditions that can trace their way back to the ancient teachings, but for the unadulterated propagation of the Eastern teachings, and it was a marriage in a sense of the West as well, because Gnosticism is the religious, is the Western, the Western mystical tradition. So there we have it. There's much more on trees, but our time is limited. So at this time, we're going to hear about the lotus.
As was stated earlier, last week we dealt with, if you could think of, as the mineral kingdom. And today we're dealing with the vegetable kingdom. So we speak of the lotus. We wanted to bring about the part of the idea of the language of the soul, and therefore the soul of all languages, and that is symbols. And that language is universal. So we're going to try to look at this idea of the lotus flower. And we thought, for those who might not be familiar with what it looked like, we did find a nice picture. It's a beautiful flower, and it does represent a lot. So if we look at it this way, we will look at it from the Buddhism, Hinduism, and the Egyptian idea. Now, for most of us that understand the idea of the flower, it has a tendency and to, at night, it retracts. All the leaves pull in tightly. And then it retracts in the water at night, and then it has to go through what we call the ideas of the muddy waters that it lives within. And then it does emerge again with the rising of the sun. So, basically, within the teachings, it brings out the part that from death to rebirth is a common understanding in those three major areas that we were speaking about, in those religions and of the period of time of the Egyptians. It does represent that part. And with the darkness and ignorance to enlightenment, we could say, and purification of going through the system of that way. So like the flower emerges from the muddy water to achieve a state of absolute purity. And we see that there's examples of those who aspire to wisdom and spiritual enlightenment. So that gives us some idea that the idea of that we could redevelop, shall we say, and re-enhance our movements at any time. In this part of it, that flower is, as they would say, is the symbol and the embodiment of the three primary attitudes connected to the ability to rise from the muddy water. Enlightenment is one. That is the emerging from that murky darkness to achieve a state of beauty, grace, and perfection. And then also we can look at the idea of purification, the purifying of the human spirit, originally born into darkness and ignorance. So these ideas follow with this whole movement of the lotus. We have a quote that comes from a story by Dara Markrasha as far as the Buddha. The spirit of the best of men is spotless, like the new lotus in muddy water, which does not adhere to it. What I would learn is that this beautiful flower gains its symbolism from the fact that it begins its life deeply rooted in the muddy pond, and then sprouts out of that muddy pond and flowers above it in a manner which its petals do not touch the pond's mud or slime. Therefore, as a symbol, the lotus can represent the growing up in a world that is full of various conflicts, impurities, while having the ability to rise above it and remained untouched. The state remaining untouched allows for enlightenment. So if we understand this, we can look at the idea of the lotus, what the muddy water represents to us. If we look at ourselves, it represents, we could say, our thoughts, our emotions, our desires, and it can become clouded, blocking it from having a clear perception of the most pure and nature and natural self. In Buddhism, many of our desires and attachments to the world, and it's through this pattern, are seen the source of all our suffering. We begin to feel we are part of what we're living versus what we know, as the idea of we are spiritual beings using a physical form to gain experience, to regain the knowledge that we know and have known. This whole idea of being unspoiled and pure considers to represent a wise and spiritually enlightened quality in the person. It is representative of someone who carries out their tasks with little concern for any reward and with a full liberation from attachment. It's very interesting how the open flower and the unopened lotus bud forms are associated with human traits. An unopened bud is representative of a folded soul that has the ability to unfold and open itself up to divine truths. So this can bring us about in that one idea of Buddhism. We see the same idea. Then, it is the association with purity and beauty in the religions of Buddhism and Hinduism, respectively, that the ancient Egyptian scholars observed that in the nighttime, the lotus closes its flower, sank into the water, and came up with a different blossoming. So, with Hinduism, this symbolizes, as it says, we've said before, is the beauty, the spirituality, the prosperity, the fertility. And the Gita is an excellent, the Bhagavad Gita, is an excellent counsel for people to live like the lotus. Work without being attached to the results. Dedicate our actions to the supreme being we are and be untouched by sinful and thoughts and deeds, just as the flower is. And we would continue life after life, aspiring to wisdom and spiritual enlightenment. That unopened bud represents a folded yet pure soul that under the right conditions can emerge into the light and open itself to divine truth. So that brings us about to the idea of what happens when we look at the meaning of the lotus flower to the ancient Egyptians. In ancient Egypt, there were two types of lotus. One that grew was the white, and the blue the blue lotus. There are also many different colors of the lotus that represents different parts of our nature. So with that in mind, we try to state that all of these ideas hold down to that one understanding. And hopefully, if we have a better understanding of the lotus flower and its meaning across those three major cultures, it's no wonder that these civilizations have found wonderment in such a beautiful flower. So those basically are what we're looking at, is what they represent. We also have interesting what it means as far as what can be done and what can't be done, and the fact that we are like that, that we have that part of our nature. So in this idea of the lotus, we also had some other things we found that we found very helpful. This is a book by Mandy Peterson, and it's called I Am the Lotus, Not the Muddy Pond. And in this whole situation, it comes through that becoming a more open locus can help heal the world for all of us in our own little ways, in all that we intertwine and meet with. And here's where she states, in no way do I claim to be on the path of enlightenment. I'm merely a student. What I write about is largely my own journey as I learn to see the pond's mud for what it is. Mud. M-U-D. In the end, I believe our ability to and find our lotus self, with a capital S, is dependent upon being able to let go of the need to conform to various ways of the world's and also the world's lifestyle. When more of us are able to do this, we will begin to purify the pond, and then we will have the capacity to bring real love and inspire unity, peace into our world. So we are like that. And also the idea to keep in mind that this lotus is also a symbol of hope, that it's our ability to rise out of that pond of mud, in a way, becomes that symbol of hope. And each stage of the lotus represents a stage of awakening. Awakening then and being becomes the ability to fully see the pond. So we think the whole idea of this flower and what it represents is very interesting. And it's easy for us to understand that the world we live in is the world we have made for ourselves. No one else from the outside has made our life as it is. So in each rebirth, we will work on that same system, that same trial of being more aware of who and what we really are. Spiritual beings reincarnating to balance off the karmic ties we have made from life to life previously. And that is our ideas that we have picked up from the idea of the locusts. Questions?
It was mentioned during the presentation that symbols are the language of the soul, and that in the vegetable kingdom, sensation creation is that degree of intelligence that's awakened. What lessons are there to be learned from sensation in the vegetable kingdom that we could use in our own soul evolution?
That's a very interesting question. What could we learn from the vegetable kingdom? Oh, is this in connection?
Well, we were thinking in terms of the tree. We usually think of the tree sensation in a very limited way, like the roots are attracted to water and the sun, and the leaves are attracted to the sunlight, in other words, for its own sustenance. But modern scientific researchers have understood that the leaves of the trees or the plants are sensitive to what's happening to other trees. And so if you burn or cut the leaf of one tree, the other leaves will respond. So it reminds us that our sensitivity or our awareness is, cannot just be for ourselves, but has to expand out to an awareness and sensitivity of our interconnection with all of life.
And wouldn't you say that in a way, the way we are affected about a situation in our life or others' lives, the way we are affected is by the connection that we too, like we've always heard the story of wherever a mother is, she has a certain feeling for her children. We don't care where in the world you go. They all have that same ability to cry over something painful of their children or the joy that they feel. They all have that same expression. Yes?
It's, oddly enough, trees are also communicating to other trees a warning. If there's trouble, the tree will produce a chemical and it sends that out into the air, and the other trees are warned and can produce the same thing for themselves. So it's a huge system that we really know nothing about.
Yes.
I believe that the common denominator between all three is the scientific principle of cohesion, which is what I think the tree somehow has some sort of empathetic cohesion in its environment, and I believe siblings and close-knit families have this sort of maybe even psychic cohesion. What the whole principle from the seed to the leaf is all cohesion, and that's probably something that I've been trying to get into my life is to let it flow. You know what I mean? So, I think that's pretty. A symbol inside a symbol, I think. Just the scientific rawness of it to derive that sort of
interconnection.
Spirituality. That's really cool. Thank you. That's, appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. Symbol within a symbol. It's interesting because there are seven keys to every symbol, and we need to actually find the keys ourselves. They're hidden, but some of them are obvious. But before there was language, there was symbolism. And, there's still certain scripts in the world that are highly symbolic, other than English, which is not. But there are many scripts that are highly symbolic. And you can kind of like, you don't even really know how to read as per se to understand the symbols. Yes?
To follow up on that previous contribution, the cohesion in the mineral kingdom seems to be primarily of physical forces. Of course, we see that in the plant kingdom as well. But we add to that the cohesion produced by consciousness or awareness or sensitivity in the plant kingdom. And it's interesting that we use that in terms of families. We speak of our family tree. But it's not just a blood connection, a physical connection. It's also an emotional connection that we have with distant relatives, past, present, and extended family as well as our nuclear family is a cohesiveness that's beyond just the physical.
And with the DNA now, everybody's searching their family trees. And it is interesting that, to see the cohesion and to see patterns that are repeated again and again within families. This gentleman? Has...
In the Gita, it talks about the three qualities. Tamas, Rajas, and Sattva. Well, one would think that the mineral kingdom has a lot of qualities of the Tamas quality. Mm-hmm. So can we infer that these three qualities, which are found throughout our environment, throughout this manifest world, are the leading cause of some of these minerals and plant life and animal life?
Yes, definitely. Because when you think about those qualities, we have them within us too. We have that sattva quality, that higher searching quality. Raja is that energy that motivates us, that keeps us moving. And then we have that tamas quality within us too, of just sort of laying back and letting it go. So the idea that within each human being we can express those three qualities just like the other kingdoms can in different ways, sometime a combination of the two qualities or three qualities, sometimes the one. But the fact that if we can see those qualities within us and see where we need to make the correction from way down and way up to get it to get sort of be in the middle, to be the observer of how we're acting and thinking and reacting to others, that would help us understand ourselves and others in a deeper quality and let it be known that sometimes they're all together, sometimes it might be one exists in an individual more than the other, but the fact that coming from the sensations, coming from, what is it, from sensations, when you get to the animal kingdom, you're coming to instinct.
Ability.
The ability of expressing that and knowing it. We go through that at times. Something, we might be doing something instinctually, something tells us this is not the right way. I need to restart or relook or combine things. I need to check it out. It's just in us. That's the knowledge we already have gained in previous lives. And every so often, intuitively, we have a glimpse of that knowledge, knowing this is right, this is balanced, this is wrong, this is not balanced.
There's an interesting study on the consciousness in plant life. Mm. On the internet, if you look up Dr. Chandar Bose, B-O-S-E, and see all the experiments that he did, including one where a leaf of a plant is put inside boiling water, and the resulting graph that's produced is the plant screams. When they drop a live shrimp into the boiling water, where the plant has its leaf in the boiling water, the plant goes out of its mind, which means it's responding to the taking of a life from the animal kingdom. So there's a lot of fascinating things you can study about this communication and interconnectedness.
We're just wondering, did this individual write a book about this? Because there is a book out.
Yes, and there's several other books.
That really, when you start to read it, you're fascinated with all the interconnection that we normally have and we don't even realize it with all the kingdoms.
Yes, sir.
I'm listening to you talking about the metaphor of the tree and the lotus brings me to mind, too, the use of the Tao and the fact that the Tetrachetus. I don't know if I'm saying it correctly, but I've read it many times. I understand it. The idea that the 1 through 4 equals 10. Right. So depicted in the circle is the circle being the cosmos, and the first differentiation is the seed, or the dot in the middle, the first cause.
Right.
And then as it divides into two, it becomes duality, then you have the line in the middle. But then it descends into matter and materialism, and that's the symbol, the tap within the circle.
Right.
And it's that very same system that descending into matter and materialism, that you're talking about the lotus being born out of the mud, as it grows back out, that forms the cross within the circle. And I think that's very much a key to most of the theosophical ideas and concepts out of that idea of the Tetrachetus.
Yeah, that's one key. Certainly trees are like triangles. A pine tree is a little more obvious, but and it symbolizes like the three higher principles in a sense. Yes?
One of the symbols brought out was the seed. Now, the seed symbolism is interesting because in the tree, as was pointed out, it represents all the future generations.
Right, right.
But the seed in the lotus, though, is quite unique as well. And we're wondering if you could speak about what's so unusual about the lotus seed and what it might represent.
Oh, you know what?
It's like a copy of it.
Yeah, it is a copy of it. If you have a chance afterward, look at this closely, and you can see visually what's going on with the seeds. And also in that center pod, we found it interesting that it is two sets of seven. It starts off three, then it goes four, and another seven. And again, from a closed position to an opening position, it's going through, and it's like, you can tell from that what it's going to look like when it's in full bloom, and also the closing of it, the way it closes and interlocks. Now, we're not sure if this is exactly what you had in mind.
Well, we think you touched on it, the idea that there's a full copy of that plant that will unfold already within the seed. Now, how do we apply that to our human situation, that idea?
Well, we could say the same thing about ourselves. There are high points and there are low points, and there are, as we stated, those different states that we go through. We can see, if you really look, you can sort of get an idea of what you've been through, not so much of what you're going to go through, but what you've been through by the way you interact with others, the way you interact with yourself. There are high points and there are medium points and there are low points. But the fact is, each one of us has our own, shall we say, signature.
And we have the seeds, the skandhas, are those electromagnetic principles which are
come back.
They come back. They're there, and they're in a sense the same type that we left behind will come back to us. Like attracts like, in that sense. In the back,
we've heard the term. As above, so below. And another term, universal brotherhood. If above, so below, then the term brotherhood has a great significance. Likeness says exist in every department of nature. So then we can say that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature.
We can state that. That's what is. That's the whole basis for the Theosophical Society movement, the United Lodge of Theosophists. that universal brotherhood is a fact in nature, and it is sexless, and it is all kingdoms combined in one huge brotherhood where there's no divisions except what we perceive as divisions, which are illusions. Follow up?
Yeah. And then that means that by study and otherwise, we can at least determine the nature of all existing things and the source of that nature within each and every one. Isn't that another way of speaking of atomic science? If you want to be material about it, but there's a moral side too that we have to look at. What is the moral seed of the basis of our immortality?
Okay. What is the moral seed of our immortality? Someone want to expound on that? Go ahead.
I think the one thing you have to is you have to come to terms with existence. And when I say come to terms, I mean just acknowledgement. You don't necessarily have to define, you don't have to pick apart every fractional thing, which I think goes to the seed. I think if I look at myself now, there are fractional reproductions
We were just asking you to direct your comments up here, so they're kind of for everyone. That's okay. That's just the way. Oh, that's just the way we operate here. That's fine. That's fine. So, did you have more to say? I don't mean to cut you off.
I think the acknowledgement of existence doesn't necessarily have to define itself. You just sort of have to share and respond to the existence the same way with science or the brotherhood of we're all here, whether we can't be separated in this realm other than when we choose to separate or divorce ourselves or ignore the very logical connections. That's all. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Okay. That's good.
We were thinking, you know, that is so true because most of the way each individual thinks has been colored by what it has been put upon them through the family, through the news, through the intercommunication. A lot of things that we say, well, my idea is, it's not really ours. We never created it. It's stuff that's been coming from the outside, constantly bantered onto us, that we sort of gravitate towards and think, well, this is great. Well, maybe when we're 12, we thought certain things were great. But by the time we were 18, we can't imagine how we even thought that way. And we're constantly bombarded from the outside. If we could learn to find that little peace and time through, be it a yoga, be it through meditation, to just silence all that outside and listen to the silence within us, we might be very surprised. And is starting out, let it be 3 minutes, let it be five. See how long you can sit and quiet your mind from bouncing here, there, memories, thoughts, just to hold it onto something, pick some situation, something to think upon, and see how long you can control your mind. Our mind just is running constantly. Yes, way in the back.
It's interesting that kind of meditation in the Eastern systems, the Tantra yoga system, is called meditation with the seed.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's likened unto a tree as you water or nourish that seed idea with your mind, it begins to sprout and grow and reach out and extend to many other ideas. But like the roots, as it extends, it attracts other things to it. So from that one act of meditation on a certain idea, we gain knowledge and insights from sources we would not otherwise consider.
It's interesting. We had a tree for 14. It's kind of personal, but it's not really. We had lived in a place for over a dozen years, and when we planted the tree, it grew and it thrived. It was a beautiful tree. It grew bigger than the house. But just as we were getting ready to move, not that this had any connection, just coincidental, the tree started to die. And what happened was it actually had wrapped its roots around itself and cut off all circulation and cut off all connection with the earth, with the ground it was rooted in. And it was not native to North America, the tree. It's actually native to Norway. But we thought that was an interesting analogy of how if we close ourselves in, if we wrap ourselves up, if we cut off our connection, we wither and die, as it were, at least for this one lifetime. We can, you know, or for that period of time until we start to reach out again. So, yes.
But there is one reality, and that is the fact that we're electromagnetic beings. So therefore, we attract to ourselves, and we're dynamic generators of force. So our moral equivalency is how we are, how we live our life, how, you know, what's real and what's not real. And if we could look at ourselves as being this electromagnetic dynamos that produce energy but also receive it, we would be we would find that by study, meditation, and things of that nature, our whole being would change.
Well, that is a seed thought that you just described, that we are electromagnetic beings and that we're dynamos, and that we can, just like the seed, there's stuff going on there that we can't see with the eyes, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It does.
We need to become a large strainer.
A sieve?
Or a sieve, or a strainer. But the fact of the matter, we just take outside stuff for granted, and it comes right in. We need to be in control of what we're going to see, what we're going to listen to, what we're going to read, how we're going to act. We need to be in control, not all the outside effects that are magnetically pulled to us. We need to grow and develop.
We need to sift out separate the wheat from the chaff, as it were. Sift out that negativity, because that will just make us withdraw into ourselves. All the way in the back?
Yeah, 2 points. One is, if we're electromagnetic beams, we also have two poles.
That's right.
And one is to repel. So be cautious about what you repel as well as what you attract. And the second thought is that the great acronym of LOTUS is that LOTUS is language of the universal soul.
Repeat that, please.
Language of the universal soul is an acronym for LOTUS, and that's what the acronym is. Yes.
Yeah. So I was thinking about the universal brotherhood and the challenges involved with that, and the idea of suffering and how to take part in that transfer of energy and share in evolution and becoming a brother, how that suffering is a part of that, and how to understand that type of suffering that we need to endure to do our part and become. become a brother.
That's interesting, yeah, because suffering is something that we all suffer. It's something that we need to transmute, and that's the alchemy, how to transmute that suffering from lead into gold. In the back?
The story mentioned from the platform reminded us of something we've observed, that in this beautiful home building, there is a tree that grows literally right out of the side of the building. And we don't mean a branch, we're talking about the trunk, and every year it blooms and proceeds. And the people that live there could well cut it down. Mm-hmm. But they leave it there as a reminder to them that their nature is like that tree, that they don't need the best environment, the most fertile soil in the world to be like that tree. They can grow, they can prosper in the most difficult and unlikely of conditions. So we think that was interesting. And of course, there are trees that grow in the desert as well.
Right. If they can find a source for water, they'll grow.
This idea of universal brotherhood and what we can do. But we all know that suffering is the great motivator. If we owe to him who does not suffer, because that's how we seem to come or confront our shortcomings, through suffering. As a human being, we wish to alleviate the suffering of others, but most of the suffering is caused by wrong ideas. So by being a theosophist and sharing these ideas with as many as you can, this relieves suffering, to know that we're responsible for everything that comes to us.
And we like the Greek word symbiosis, literally means living together, and that's what we need to learn how to do, is to live together. And we can look at the tree, our relationship with the trees, because we breathe out CO2, they breathe it in, they breathe out oxygen, we breathe in the oxygen. So there's we need them, we to live together. There's a symbiotic relationship. One more, yes, or two, maybe. Go ahead.
So the story of your tree reminds me of, and we're talking about universal brotherhood here, giant redwoods in California. They can grow, they grow for 1,000 years. The tallest trees in the world, and they can batter storms, winds, and everything, but the way they survive is that when they grow their roots, they intertwine their roots with the other roots of the other trees. So they all stand together, they all protect each other, and that's how they survive.
That's interesting. They can also send out, from what we understand, when different borers and different insects come in, they can actually send out toxins, and that's how they survive for thousands of years. They literally have their own insecticide within them. Did you want to close? Or?
Yes. We'd like to just close with one little thought that could be, as we're coming to the idea of the thought of the collective consciousness within us. We all have our own individual consciousness and can make individual decisions. But the collective forms its own body of consciousness and makes its own decision, which are subject to the same laws of manifestation that our individual consciousness is. In fact, many of our thoughts may not solely be our own. They may result from us being tapped into that bigger pond of consciousness. Ultimately, we both affect the collectivity consciousness, with our individual thoughts and are affected by it as well. So that gives us a lot that we can learn from that vegetable kingdom. And that's it. Up a little higher. Good here.